Welcome to our second season of Spirited Discussions. I'm Lachlan Watt, and I have over 10 years' experience in both the spirits and bar industries, while also having an insatiable thirst for understanding the booze that we drink. Through this series, we will dive deeper into the topics that we have grazed in season one and dive into some other historical tidbits that have guided our drinking habits. Join me through our second season, and well, let's get started. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Spirited Discussions. Today, we are going to be exploring Australian wine, something that my guest and I are very excited about. My guest today is a good friend of mine, Claire Harmon, a wine expert who's actually just happens to be in Melbourne for the weekend. So we decided to jump on this opportunity while we had it. So welcome. Thank you for joining me.
Thanks, Lucky. It's so good to be here.
It's so good to have you back in my life.
Oh, it's been too long.
I know, far too long. Before we dive in, I'd like to get your history in the industry and, you know, what led you to alcohol in general.
I've had a bit of a diverse, long history with alcohol.
So
I guess I did the classic straight out of high school into uni situation. So I did a science degree and then decided that a career wasn't in my future at 20 years old. And so I went on and did lots of traveling, and to fund my travel, I did the classic hospitality thing. Started that in Perth and then moved over to Melbourne. Melbourne was a whole revelation because just the step up and all the opportunities, what everyone's doing over there. So I did some cocktail stuff, discovered Whiskey and Ailment, which I absolutely loved, was my favourite bar of all time, and begged my way into a job there. worked in Whiskey and Ailment for a while, and then was also working in restaurants, writing beverage lists for places. And then needed to move out of hospitality, went back to uni, did a postgraduate degree in winemaking in Adelaide, did some vintages, made some wine, moved to Kangaroo Island, started distilling, making some gin, and then finally I've ended up in Tasmania making whiskey, which has been a long-term goal, and, working for Overeem Distillery, which is pretty phenomenal. They're really great.
Yeah, they're pretty good. They're not bad.
I really like them.
Oh, we love them. one of my favourite opportunities was to select that cast that we did for Whiskey and Ailment. It's one of my favourite experiences in this industry, well, in my side of the industry at least. How long were you making wine in South Australia?
I did two vintages, and then because I just wanted to determine whether or not I really wanted to go down that path. So before I went and studied, I went and worked in the industry. So two vintages in McLaren Vale, and then did a kind of vintage at uni as well. And then after uni, I was doing more vineyard work and more casual still stuff around the outside times and the grapevines. It's pretty good.
And what period of the year is a vintage? So a vintage happens once a year.
Yeah.
So what period of the year is out here in Australia?
Yeah, so it happens like early in the year. So often sometimes it can be a bit confusing because a vintage can happen over 2 years if you pick stuff really, if things ripen really early.
Yeah.
But just to simplify it, it generally happens at the beginning of each year is when the grapes are ripened at the end of summer.
Yeah.
And then you pick them and you make the wine. So maybe starting in February, March, and then going through to April if it's in a cooler climate can go all the way through to May. That's not so common.
You'd be looking more kind of regional Victoria kind of area for anything that would happen like that rather than the stuff you were seeing in South Australia where it is warmer and more.
It all just kind of happens at once in that warm climate. So it's just held to the leather for a couple of months and
South
then everything's
Australia's
in.
Very busy.
Yes. Yeah. Lots of wine happens over there. All right, Lachlan, so I'm very much looking forward to this 60-second history of wine that I've been told is happening.
Yes, we do. We do that. And I'm a bit ashamed for what's about to happen.
But, why?
Well, this is your area of things and, you know, it's never really been my forte. So this has been a fun little piece of research for me.
Yeah.
But let's see how I can get through this.
Let's see how you go.
Yep.
I'm ready.
All right, you ready?
Yeah.
Tell me when.
Okay, ready? 3, 2, 1, go.
Well, the origin of wine in Australia loosely begins in 1788 with the First Fleet, where there were a few vines planted around where the Royal Botanic Gardens is in Sydney, although they did not thrive that well. It wasn't until a little bit later when a man named James Busby, known as the father of Australian wine, successfully grew grapes in the Hunter Valley in New South Wales. And then from that, travelled to Spain and France and learnt about winemaking and came back and was teaching people winemaking and successfully making wine. The cuttings that he brought back were Shiraz and Grenache mainly. Up until the 1960s, most wineries around Australia were focused on fortified wines like port and sherry style wines, which we call Tawny and Apera, and then later Muscats and Topakes as well. And then we slowly moved towards table wines during the 60s after a large immigration from countries like Italy and Greece. Since then, we have developed a regional diversity that has now become renowned for innovative techniques.
Yes! Woo! 6 seconds to go.
Done.
Oh my gosh, I'm honored.
Get better a little bit all the time.
Yeah. That was good.
Yeah, thank you.
Yeah.
I'm happy with that.
Yeah.
Well, let's dive into this straight away. What was your first experience with wine and what was it that excited you about wine?
Oh, I mean, first experience with wine.
Yeah.
My dad gave me some port when I was like 10.
Yeah.
But what got me like into wine as a professional person or like a person that drinks wine all the time. Look, it's delicious.
That is true, yes.
But also I think it's such a diverse thing and it's enjoyed by such a diverse range of people.
Yeah.
And then I remember like I was writing beverage lists and my first, I guess, like love in that industry was cocktails. You know, you put all this energy into this cocktail list and what recipes you're going to do, what flavors, and then you have a look at the end of the night and you see just like wine. Wine is just the largest consumed category in so many restaurants. And I wanted to learn more about it because I wanted to offer my guests like the best experience starting out. Like I was curating these lists and I probably didn't know as much about wine as I could, and that was a big driver.
Well, wine is such a universal category. There's wine being made in every country around the world. It's so universal, so unanimous, so ubiquitous.
Mm-hmm.
And every country or every region has its own, like you said, diversity. It's what interested me through learning from you about it initially.
Yeah, and it's such a celebration drink.
It is, yeah.
Like, you know, you get a beautiful bottle of wine if you're celebrating, or like you can even go like real cerebral and be like, you know, the Eucharist,
yeah,
the bread and the wine. And I think also like probably a bit shame to say about the whole like blind tasting wine party trick.
Yeah, yeah.
I would see that happening. I was like, what? How do I figure out how this is done?
Like, being able to blind taste it and go, I know exactly where that's from.
Yeah, this is a Chardonnay from the south of France. I was just like, how?
Mm.
How can you know that? And so I needed to find out. That was like a big catalyst. That was just so fascinating.
That's something I really wish I could do, but the amount of time and energy I'd have to put into it is just so enormous.
It's huge.
It becomes your entire life.
Yeah.
So that's not going to happen. well, let's dive in. Today I want to break down some of the more common regions around Australia and understand the varieties that are produced in these regions and why they differ.
Mm.
Now, we're not going to touch on every region because we'd be here for hours and hours and hours upon end, because it is such a broad country and there are so many regions around Australia producing incredible wine, right?
Right.
From the Hunter Valley in New South Wales or like towns like Orange or what have you around Australia. But we're only going to kind of focus on the main ones today. We can build it out later on if we ever choose to.
Yeah.
So let's start with South Australia. Now we're going to bring in all of those to one, basically.
Okay.
So Barossa Valley, what's special about Barossa?
Well, the Barossa is really a big part of what put Australian wine on the map.
Yeah.
And it's one of the oldest wine growing regions.
I think second just to Hunter Valley.
Yeah. And the cool thing about the Barossa is there's so much old vine material, so vines that were planted over 100 years ago.
Yeah.
I know you guys have talked about this on the podcast previously, but there was this little mite that came in and destroyed lots of Europe's vineyards, Phylloxera. Yeah. And it never got to Australia, and it still isn't in South Australia. So we're so uniquely positioned, particularly in the Barossa, to have this like old vine material.
Yeah.
And these old vines produce just such a small amount of grapes.
Yeah.
And those grapes have such high concentration of flavour.
Yeah.
So the wines that you can get out of these grapes are like quite intense. And that's very unique to Barossa, and it's unique to Australia, and it's something like it should be celebrated. It's really cool.
And there are the classic wine that put the Barossa on the map is like the big, bold Australian Shiraz, right?
Yeah, big time. The Barossa Shiraz.
It's globally famous, this mm-hmm. category. And like I've got it's a very small style Barossa Shiraz, a tiny, tiny winery called Ballycroft. And these guys actually mention on their label, they say small berry Shiraz.
Mm.
So they're trying to highlight that concentration of flavour,
mm-hmm.
which is super cool.
Yeah. So I guess Barossa Shiraz, they're known for their big, rich, like concentrated wine. So it's like the wine that your dad loves. And then those wines when after you've had a glass, you're like your whole entire mouth is like black.
Yeah. Big oak, big fruit.
Yeah.
Yeah. Big flavour.
Yeah, and the way that they can get that, like, concentration is because the Barossa Valley, it's so, like, it's nice and warm and it allows lots of time for those grapes to really ripen on the vine, and that gives, like, so much sugar and so much intensity to the wine. And then in the winery, there's certain things that you can do in terms of, like, ageing it in quite, like small oak barrels, I guess.
Yeah.
Like, that impart quite a lot of influence into the wine, and that oak... the sweetness and the sugars and the richness of the oak marry really well with that huge concentration of that fruit from those vines that have been allowed to really age and increase their sugar ripeness. And that's how Barossa Shiraz kind of came to be.
Well, we also in Australia tend to use a lot of American oak compared to French oak, which is what's used over in Europe mm-hmm. predominantly for winemaking, right? Mm. And then American oak will have a bit more sweetness to impart as well.
Yeah.
And richness. And
that's a huge part of that Barossa profile too. It's kind of like it's a similar thing in Spain. They tend to use American oak.
Yeah.
And in Australia it's certainly a thing. And like, you know, if we're talking back to those amazing people that can blind taste, often if you see that American oak influence, you can think Barossa.
Yeah. It's really, really interesting. There's also a few white wines that are grown there, like, you know, Chardonnays and Rieslings and all of that. Let's move on to McLaren Vale.
Mm-hmm.
Very similar in style, right?
Yeah, in terms of like big intensity of fruit for sure. It's a bit different in terms of the environment that the grapes are grown, because McLaren Vale have these incredible beaches. It's quite much more coastal than Barossa.
Yeah.
And the advantage of being near the coast is that the ocean can help cool the environment that the grapes are maturing in. So they probably... aren't so that their concentration of flavor is big, but it's not like Barossa Valley big. Like
it's big. You know, a bit more gentle and dare I say elegant, but it's not still, it's still monstrous, you know, wine comparatively.
Yeah. And I mean, McLaren Vale, they have just like any wine region, they have little subsets of soils and microclimates. And a lot of the time you can see, particularly like in McLaren Vale Shiraz, a kind of a note that you see that's quite unique is this like ironstone influence that makes the Shiraz taste like blood.
Yeah, yeah.
Like particularly as it ages, which is such an odd note. But if you've ever cut yourself and you like just instinctively put your finger like in your mouth to stop it, that kind of, I don't know how to describe it.
Yeah, it kind of coppery, irony mm-hmm. kind of.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's like a bloody note to the sometimes in McLaren Vale Shirazes.
That's interesting. I'll need to look out for that now when I drink McLaren Vale Shiraz.
Yeah. When you see it, it just hits you in the face and you're like, that can only be from one place.
Well, all right. And some of my favourite wines that come out of McLaren Vale are the Spanish and Italian varieties mm-hmm. like Montepulciano and stuff like that are grown in that region.
Yeah.
That are lesser known. I love those big, heavy Italian and Spanish styles anyway.
Yeah, I guess they're lesser known because they're newer.
Yeah.
So a lot of these, you know, the first vines that got planted in Australia were very much French style.
Yeah, yeah.
If you think about the climate in France, it tends to be a lot cooler than certainly like the Barossa Valley and McLaren Vale. And so they were having problems with getting enough water to these grapes.
Yeah.
And so instead, we started looking to places around the world that had grapes that were growing just naturally in a similar environment to Australia. So warmer and drier.
So Spain and Italy are
perfect. Spain and Italy.
Yeah.
Yeah, but like you think about these grape varieties, we haven't seen them because they've only been in Australia for about 20, 30 years.
Well, I mentioned that briefly in the history with the influence of Italian, Spanish and Greek people moving over here in the 60s especially, wanting those big, bold styles as well.
Yeah, but I mean even something like Tempranillo, that only got brought in maybe like in 91 because it's such a process to get grapevines into Australia because we're so protective of our viniculture. So we're not just like we have to make sure that there's no diseases, no viruses, and that process takes alone maybe 4 or 5 years. And then you have to grow the vines.
Yeah.
And that takes at least 3-4 years before you start yielding fruit. So, you know, it's not a short process to get new varieties into Australia and we're still just slowly seeing more and more trickle in, which I think is so exciting.
It's exciting. We're starting to see that with most industries in booze where we're starting to see so much variety come around in modern era, which is it's a perfect time to be alive if you're interested in alcohol, right?
Yeah, but it's hard to like keep up almost.
Yeah, happening so quickly.
Yeah, you just get your wrap your head around Shiraz and Cabernet and then you're just like, what are all these grape varieties? I can't now pronounce.
I know.
Yeah.
What is this Sangiovese or, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
One of my, it's a very short anecdote, but when I first started working in bars, I used to have a regular customer. We had a Tempranillo on pour and he would always come in and just walk up to me and say, one bottle of Tempranillo, thank you.
Yes.
And walk off. That was the interaction I'd have with him every week. Mm. So
the double L's are a Y.
Yeah.
It's a hot tip. But, man, just to speak to some of the complications around these new grape varieties. So Montepulciano, for example, difficult to say-ish. So Montepulciano is a grape variety but from Italy, but it's also a town in Tuscany. And the town of Montepulciano grows Sangiovese.
Yeah.
So, you know, keep up. Good luck. Keeping track.
It just keeps on changing, keeps on moving, and there's so much information behind it all. Adelaide Hills, which is next to, a bit further north of Adelaide, right?
Yeah. I mean, Adelaide rocks.
Yeah.
Because all of these regions that we've said so far are like within 1 hour.
This is why we're trying to do them all together, because they're so close together.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Adelaide Hills, and this is a cooler climate, more white wine driven area, right?
Yeah. So I'd say you want to be looking at those previous grape varieties more for reds, although there are some awesome, particularly like Italian grape white varieties that come out of there. But then when you want to get into your Chardonnays and your Rieslings and your Pinot Grigios, white wine needs a little bit of a cooler environment to show its best, in my opinion. And so we're up to Adelaide Hills, which has some nice altitude that helps cool things down a little bit.
Yeah. And then finally, Clare Valley.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what comes out of Clare Valley?
Riesling. Well, lots of things.
Yeah.
Riesling is what it's famous for, like world famous for.
Yeah.
Like benchmark Riesling famous for.
And that's very similar to that kind of southern German Alps kind of style, right?
Mm-mm.
No.
Like Australian Riesling is quite unique in style because ours is so dry.
Yeah.
Like a lot of European Rieslings will help balance a lot of the freaking high acidity with a little bit of residual sugar. So that in Europe you can add a little bit of sugar back into the grape juice after you've harvested it.
That's called dosage, right?
Mm. Yes.
Yes.
It is. But in Australia, you're not allowed to do that. So if we want an off-dry wine or a sweeter, some sugar in our wine, we have to stop the fermentation before all the yeasties eat all the sugar.
Yeah.
But what it's kind of led to is like a more unique Australian Riesling style.
Yeah.
Which is quite high acidity, really, really clean, a lot of minerality, a lot of citrus like lemon lime, lemon lime. Different.
I've got a South Australian Riesling here, which is from one of our favourite producers at the moment, which is Riesling Freak.
Yeah, they're so cool.
And this is actually a blend of Barossa and Clare Valley Riesling.
Barossa and Clare?
Well, it's Eden Valley, which is, you know, just
kind of on the top of Barossa.
Yeah.
I mean, they're all so close, but.
But yeah, it's such a cool style at the moment.
No, I kind of really want to open it.
We can. I did say we won't, but
I know. One bottle we said.
Mm-hmm. Well, Yarra Valley. So we're in Victoria.
Yeah.
And, you know, it's hard to talk just about, you know, just about the Yarra Valley because there is so much wine being made around Victoria. But the Yarra Valley is probably the most common or the most recognised.
Yeah, I think it was the first plantings in Victoria.
It was, yeah. But, yeah, so what comes out of Yarra Valley?
Pinot and Chardonnay, Riesling, sparkling wine.
Yeah.
Things that like it a bit cooler.
Yeah. And I think the heaviest wine that comes out of there is something like Cab Sav or...
Yeah, but that will just be like a different style altogether with some Cab Sav that comes out of McLaren Vale or the Barossa. Yeah.
So, yeah, mostly those kind of cool climate reds or whites. Yeah. So with the Yarra Valley, let's talk about Pinot Noir because Pinot Noir is so popular around the country. So let's dive into Yarra Valley Pinot.
Yeah, I mean, and Pinot doesn't love hot weather, so there's not much Pinot coming out of South Australia.
No.
So, yeah, when you get cool climate, you get the opportunity to grow some of the most delicious grapes that make the most delicious wine. Pinot is, it's just so delicious. I know I've said that a million times.
Yeah, but it is, well, it's a lighter red, right? It's a lighter bodied red and that's because it is a cool climate wine.
Yeah, it's really difficult to grow. So because that colour is quite light for Pinot because the grape skins are quite thin.
Mm-hmm.
And with thin grape skins means that they're more susceptible to disease and like birds can easily and insects things can easily attack them. And so they're much more difficult to grow than something like Cabernet that has teeny tiny robust berries.
And Shiraz where they're tiny but very thick skin.
Yeah.
It's, like, it's, you know, 5% skin.
Yeah, so you'll notice that there's not a lot of Pinot Noir at the bottle shop that's $10 a bottle because you can't – it's very difficult and expensive to grow these grapes and to make the wine. So – Pinot is this premium, delicious wine. You have to pay a bit more money for it, but it's light, but it often has quite a lot of complexity and a lot of intensity of flavour, and you can pull lots of different flavour notes out of there, quite unique too.
I've always found that Pinot really, as far as my limited understanding of wine, I've always found Pinot a much kind of more neutral sounding board for that sense of terroir because it always has an earthiness to it, but that earthiness changes based on the locale of where those grapes are grown.
Yeah, I love that.
And it, maybe because it is a softer wine comparatively to, say, your Shiraz or Cabernet where it's not as rich, it's easier to pull out that terroir.
Yeah, that's a great point. And often Pinot, it doesn't get aged in big, rich oak casks.
No.
So it'll be neutral oak. And what that means is, perhaps it's an oak barrel that's been used numerous times before and so it's kind of like reusing a tea bag.
Yeah.
So that intensity of colour and flavour just really softens as the cask gets used over and over and it just gives the grapes a chance to shine and then the grapes are such a reflection of where they're grown and so that doesn't get hidden away behind oak.
Yeah. Well, I should quickly talk about what terroir is.
Oh, yeah.
Because
yeah, try and explain that simply.
Yeah, that's, I guess in the simplest terms, it's a sense of place. It is a reflection of the soil, the water that it's grown with. It happens to a plant, right? It's a plant always has terroir, where it's grown, how it's grown, the seasons that it has. That is what terroir is.
Yeah, I mean, it's everything. It's every environmental impact
that
it has. So the amount of wind it gets, the amount of sunlight it's exposed to, the soil types, the amount of water and what time of year the water reaches the vine.
Yeah.
It's how slopey the ground is that it's grown on.
Yeah.
Is it flat or is it on the side of the hill? Which side of the hill? It all ties into this sense of terroir.
Yeah.
Of wine and grapes.
And well, because it happens to oak as well because we see it with oak in whiskey because the main two types of oak that are used to mature whiskey are Quercus alba or American white oak or Quercus roba, which is European oak. But European oak is separated into where it's grown.
Mm.
And so we'll talk about French oak or Spanish oak or Portuguese oak or Hungarian oak and every one of them is different, but it's all the same species.
Yeah.
And it's all down to that sense of terroir as well.
I mean, it makes perfect sense in lots of ways, but then
it's hard, so esoteric.
Yes.
It's really, really interesting thing to try and explain.
Yeah.
And it's been broadened out in recent years, that term, to include people as well and the people who make it, which is kind of even making it more complicated and esoteric. So, all right. I think we should move on to, well, where you're from.
Yay!
And I want to quickly mention that we've been drinking this wine from this region, which is this Margaret River Chardonnay from Western Australia, that Claire kindly brought along today. Do you want to start off with Margaret River and tell us about that area?
Yeah, I mean, we're drinking a beautiful Chardonnay from McHenry Honan, one of my favourite producers down in Margaret River. They are all biodynamic with the way they farm their grapes.
Yeah.
And that's a whole different conversation for a
Can we quickly touch on just a very brief explanation of biodynamic? Because we see it a lot nowadays, especially with the introduction of things like natural wine and low intervention wines and stuff like that. So what is biodynamic?
So it is similar to organic farming.
Yeah.
So really steering clear from any synthetic pesticides or chemicals in your farming of your grapes. But biodynamics takes it a little bit further. So biodynamics is incorporating where the moon and the planets are in the solar system, and that affects how the plants might behave like day to day, week to week. And then there's also some biodynamic practices in terms of like the way that they manage their soil and the way that they fertilize their vines, like the foliage sprays that they use.
Mm-hmm.
They're all kind of created through this biodynamic processes. And then there's a pretty famous or like well-known or controversial practice of packing a cow horn with manure, and then you bury that in the spring equinox, and then you dig it back up in the autumn equinox. And those 6 months under the ground in the horn creates this amazing, like, intense compost.
Right.
And that compost is used and mixed in, like, quite a large volume of water as, like, a tincture for the soil. And so there's those kind of things that happen. And some people think it's a bit, like...
Hippy-dippy.
Hippy-dippy.
Yeah.
But I think there's something certainly to be said by really paying close attention to what's happening in the environment of your vineyard.
So it's not so much the practices, it is that sense of close watch and
stewardship over what's happening on your land.
Rather than set and forget kind of.
Yeah, nature. Yeah. I mean, look, I'm not against biodynamic. I think it's freaking awesome.
Yeah.
But if you want to be really scientific about it.
Yeah.
There perhaps isn't that much difference between organics and biodynamics in terms of the impact of your viticulture.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know, I just love it. I just love trying to incorporate as much of the natural world into whatever you're doing.
It's a natural product, right? It is a natural product. It's a natural process.
And its byproduct is just you regenerating the land and you helping the soil and you leaving the world better than where you found it.
Mm-hmm.
And that's cool.
Yeah.
And I think that makes the best wine. Whether it be biodynamics or organics or regenerative agriculture, just paying attention and putting some mindfulness towards what you're doing to the world.
Yeah.
I think it's going to serve you in terms of quality.
I absolutely agree. I love that added sense of care. I think if that's applied to the growing of the vines, it's also applied to then the production of the wine as well.
Yeah.
And that's obviously, if you pay that close attention, you're going to produce a better quality product than if you paid less attention.
I mean, just that simple distilled fact.
Yeah, yeah.
That has got to be such a huge part of it.
Exactly.
It?
So, Margaret River.
Margaret River. So this is my hometown.
Yeah.
And this, like, if we're talking about blind tasting of wines, I've got the best chance to be able to pick blind a Margaret River wine than most other wines. I don't know what it is. I guess it's just like a part of me.
Yeah. The sense of home, sense of place.
Yeah, yeah. Just I honestly, you smell it and I'm like, wow, that smells like home. That must be Margaret River.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess the great varieties that Margaret River is really known for, Chardonnay, Cabernet Shiraz, but also some great varieties that we haven't touched on yet that perhaps got a little bit like out of favour, out of fashion.
Yeah.
Which is Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon.
And they're coming back, which is great.
Well, I'm glad.
Because they're good wines as well. They've just been treated poorly.
Yeah. And I mean, so Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon, all of Margaret River, those the grapes that are planted are reflective of the Bordeaux region of France.
Yeah.
And if you have a look at the climate of Margaret River compared to Bordeaux, they're very, very similar. And people have done this. For like whatever wine region you want, you can kind of like match up stats and link it to the Northern Hemisphere.
Yeah.
And Margaret River is Bordeaux.
Well, that's great for us because it means we've got something local that's similar to Bordeaux because I love Bordeaux wines.
Mm, I mean, they're so beautiful and intense and expressive and expensive.
Yeah, very expensive, especially shipping wine like that across the oceans to get here makes them more and more expensive anyway. So if we can get them locally.
Yeah, yeah. And, I mean, they're not going to be exactly like Bordeaux because, you know, I find Margaret River wines have this like amazing eucalypt character.
Well, yeah, there's Australiana to it.
Yeah, and that's cool.
Yeah.
But Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon, they've been staple white wine varieties grown down there since, you know, that region kind of got established in the 1980s, which is pretty recently.
Yeah.
But, yeah, they planted these great varieties and I guess they make them less in that Marlborough, New Zealand fruit bomb style. And particularly they're moving away from that really like flabby, fruity style into a bit more of a picked a little bit later so it's less fruity, has a bit more texture, has lots of like intensity, has this like green, grassy, sometimes you see asparagus.
Well, I had a Sauvignon Blanc from Western Australia recently as well as a French one as well that was given to me by a friend. And they were very, very similar in style.
Mm.
They're both American oak as well, but like old American oak, not fresh American oak.
Mm-hmm.
But they reminded me of this Riesling that that you have opened.
Which I have no regrets.
No, it's phenomenal.
Yeah.
But it's got that grassiness, that green, grassy, citrus element to it, which I find really exciting and interesting.
And I have to say there is something to be said for a tropical fruit tasting wine. Like, that's delicious.
And that happens now in Sauvignon and Semillon. And Semillon is quite flabby, a very fatty, fruity grape.
Grassy
as well.
And grassy. Hay. Yeah. And I guess it gives a little bit more body to that blend. So in France, Sauvignon Blanc and Semillon are often blended.
Yeah.
And I guess Sauvignon Blanc is that top note fruitiness and then Semillon helps with a little bit more like body and richness.
Yeah, that fatty, like heavy weight to it.
And it just kind of, it gives a bit more guts to what otherwise might have been a bit of a like frilly, fruity, not so serious Sauvignon Blanc. They're a good pair.
Yeah, and they work well together. So, yeah. Yeah, that's really interesting. I need to start drinking more Sauvignon Blanc, I think.
Yeah, and blends. Sauvignon Blanc blends.
Yeah.
Mm.
Well, just blended wine is never a bad thing.
So good. And that's what, like, me working in the whiskey industry, working in single malt, like, we don't get to play with blending between distilleries. And I think, like, some of my favourite whiskies of all time, sorry to go into whiskies in a wine podcast, and I'll just say this.
It's hard not to do when it's me as well.
That some of my favourite whiskies have been blended malt whiskies.
Yeah.
And I think that's, like, the way the world and the wine industry has this ability to, like, to blend grape varieties together and to build something truly just amazing.
Well, that happens in France all the time. Some of the biggest styles of wine coming out of France are all blended. Even things like champagne and things like Côte d'Or, they're all blended by region rather than variety.
Yeah.
You know?
And in Australia, we don't have the strict rules that France does.
Mm-hmm.
And so we can blend wine from all over Australia. I mean, like Penfolds Grange is an amazing example of that. That's probably our most famous Australian wine internationally.
Yeah.
And that's a blend of Shiraz and Cabernet from different regions within Australia. And that is just such an important and powerful wine in terms of the Australian wine industry.
I think a lot of people don't realise that if a certain winery has had a bad season, they'll buy grapes from wherever they can get them from.
Yep.
And make their wine to meet their quota, basically, for the year. A lot of wineries will do that, especially the big boys.
And, I mean, even small, like, there's nothing wrong with doing that.
No.
Because small producers do that.
Yeah.
So a lot of the time, small producers don't have the funds to have their own land, particularly in these wine regions that, like, land's worth millions of dollars, and take care of their own grapes and all that kind of stuff. So often they'll... or perhaps they take care of a block of land from a particular grower themselves, or they'll select fruit from like a larger, someone who might have produced grapes for a larger producer.
Yeah.
And they'll create wines themselves, and they'll put all of their love and skills and attention into this small parcel of grapes. And I think that's a really exciting new thing that's happening in the Australian wine industry.
Well, we're seeing so much development in the wine industry currently with, yeah, these little urban producers as well, which are doing that same kind of thing. Like there's the Urban Winery here in Melbourne. I think it is just called the Urban Winery.
It's been going for a while now. It's such a cool idea, just getting the community involved in winemaking.
Yeah, and you can just go there and make your own wine as well.
Wicked.
It's really cool.
Yeah.
And you can have your own barrel with your own name on it and everything. It's it's really cute.
Yeah.
There's all these tiny producers that are doing exactly what you're saying and making natural wine or whatever they might do.
Low intervention wine. Because we spoke a little bit about biodynamics and like doing the right thing in the vineyard. But then there's a whole other conversation that can be had about doing the right thing in the winery.
Yeah.
In terms of like not messing with whatever you get off the vineyard too much.
Yeah, trying to keep the process as natural as possible.
Yeah, yeah. Because there's lots of things, lots of tools that Australian winemakers have to kind of manipulate the grapes after they've been harvested if they're not exactly how they want them. And that's not here to pass judgment on that, but certainly if you do the right thing in the vineyard and you get grapes naturally the way that you want them, and then when I was studying winemaking, it was just learning how to not stuff it up.
Yeah, yeah.
Like how to get out of the way.
There's also there's been ways that have been developed to, say you have a bad ferment or a bad batch, to fix that or, you know, rectify that. And there are some, you know, chemicals and stuff that have been put in play to fix those problems, so you don't have to turf, you know, thousands of litres of wine. But a lot of these people who are paying that close attention to growing the fruit itself, why would you not try and pay close attention and do the production on the other side as well?
Yeah, and I think part of it is just making it in smaller batches. It's not like hundreds of thousands of tons at once.
In a big concrete tank.
Yeah, that you don't, like you can't go and see and smell and touch and feel every day as it's fermenting. You can like be there with your senses.
Yeah.
Like helping that fermentation, that winemaking along. Like if it's a bit of more of an intimate relationship, I think a lot of the time it shows in the bottle.
Yeah. So, you know, what everyone talks about the secret ingredient being love, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
And that can be recognised, especially when you have these things where that close attention has been paid.
Yeah.
Now, after we've talked about all this, do you think Aussie wine stacks up globally against, you know, the big wine producing regions, namely Italy, France, Germany, Spain?
I mean, yes.
Yeah.
Australian wine is so diverse because it's such a big country. So I guess it's interesting to compare it to those, I guess we call them old world regions.
Yeah.
Like Italy, France, Germany, all those that you just mentioned. I think the difference between Australian wines a lot of the time in those regions are that we make like a clean wine.
Yeah.
And so what by that I mean, like it's free of faults. And faults, something like there's a classic cork taint fault, like your wine starts smelling like wet cardboard, and that's
the TCA,
fun.
I think it's called.
Yeah, TCA. But then there's some other infections, bacterial or yeast infections that can happen in the winery that if it's too out of control, it can really taint the flavour of the wine. So one example is Brett.
Brettanomyces.
Yeah, so it's this bacteria that grows in wine after it's been fermented. Mm-hmm. Can do if it's just kicking around.
Or in any ferment. But once it's in a production facility, it's there forever.
Yeah. And I mean, there's things that you can do to keep it at bay. It's just hard to manage. And Brettanomyces taint is really quite like famous in the old world.
Yeah.
And it tastes like, I guess, like Band-Aid, some people say, or like sweaty saddles. I don't know.
Yeah, horse saddles or a mousy kind of characteristic to it.
If you're really – and mousy is a whole nother
– thing.
Yeah, but
It's pretty common in Bordeaux as well.
Yeah, and if it's in a small concentration, it's kind of interesting or nice. And some people perceive it more than others.
Yeah, people can have sensitivities to things. Like people can be more sensitive to cork taint than others, to TCA.
Yeah.
Some people are more sensitive to Brettanomyces or even sulfur and things as well.
Yeah. So, Australian wine is far less commonly shows those taints.
Yeah.
And the reason why is because Australian winemaking has been, rather than being informed by tradition, which is great and makes these amazing wines that we love from France and Italy, these rustic, earthy wines that are so expressive of where they're grown. Australian wine industry has been really informed by science.
And it's because it's also a very modern industry. Like the table modern. Wine industry is only really coming to its own since the 60s. So
yeah, yep. And we've had like Australia has this amazing research industry called the AWRI, Australian Wine Research Institute. Yeah. Started in the 50s, and that just like did all this research into the best ways to make wine scientifically driven.
Yeah.
And that informed Australian winemakers, and this is what makes Australian wine so clean. And also Australian wine tends to be like rich and full bodied.
Yeah.
Because if you think about where we're growing these grapes,
it's a pretty harsh environment. Australia, pretty much all around the country, is pretty harsh in one way or the other, you know, so
but it's warm.
It's warm, and then this will obviously impact the grapes that are grown here. Mm-hmm. So,
yep. So it's all the way back to that terroir thing again.
Yeah.
But in terms of how Australian wine stands up against the rest of the world, I think it's got a great reputation. It's just different.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it is a new world wine, and some people can struggle with that. But I mean, you mentioned Penfolds Grange before. That's probably the most famous wine that Australia produces, but it's almost exclusively exported.
Yeah, yeah, it's huge internationally.
Yeah.
And then for whatever you have to say about Penfolds Grange, thank you for existing.
Yeah.
Because
yeah.
It's just helped our wine industry so much.
It put Australia on the map. That's and therefore right. We can then be drinking the stuff that we are today or talking about today.
Yeah, and it's just helped the industry grow. And the more it grows, the better.
Finally, are there any producers that you think we should be looking out for? I mean, we've mentioned a few today that we talked about. I really love these guys, Ballycroft and Barossa, but they're so tiny. We talked about Riesling Freak that we couldn't help ourselves but open.
Yeah.
From South Australia, and McHenry Honan. But who else do you think we should be looking out for? And what wines do you think they produce that we should be looking out for?
I mean, this is a really difficult question to answer.
Yeah.
Because there are so many producers that are so great in Australia.
It's so broad, so diverse.
And I think the recommendations that I would give, I have these recommendations because of my personal wine journey.
Mm-hmm.
Like it's almost like the wine is great and that's great, but there's another layer of like emotional attachment to these producers that I love.
That's perfect.
So this is where – so I just want to caveat these recommendations with that. Like this is not an exclusive list, obviously, but producers that I really love is Connie Killer.
Yeah, yeah.
I think they do this Shiraz Viognier blend, which has just been my top wine of the year.
Where are they based?
They're in the Canberra district.
Oh, right, yeah.
So cool climate, just freaking amazing. A few South Australian producers, Yangara, again – biodynamically farmed.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Pannell. So I used to make wine for him. And he has been such a pioneer in McLaren Vale for those Italian and French varieties that we were talking about earlier.
Yeah.
He's amazing. My recent little jaunt down to Margaret River, I found this great producer called Windows Estate. and they make these amazing little wines. So this is just like husband and wife team making incredible wine. And then down in Tassie, there's amazing Pinot and Chardonnay being produced. But one of my faves is Mewstone, I think.
Yeah.
They're Chardonnays, they're Shiraz, they're Rieslings.
Well,
awesome.
There's just so much coming out of Australia. It's hard to keep on top of it.
I know. And I'm not really super up to date with everything. I've been working in distilling for 3 years. But these are just producers that I will always love. They'll always hold a place in my heart, you know.
Well, yeah, and that's what's important, you know. that's how you personal choose connection.
Yeah, because otherwise how else do you choose?
Exactly, because it is so broadhead. It is so diverse. You've got to pick one track and stick on it, really. Sometimes, not always.
I mean, I'm open to more.
Yeah, yeah.
But if I had to, if I had to rattle off a few, I sat down and thought about that for a long time.
I was thinking about it last night as well, and yeah, Ballycroft came to mind, but also Kaleski and Barossa.
Yeah.
It is a personal favorite of Lindsay, my wife, and I. Love Kaleski, mostly me. I love their Derif. They make their 365-day ferment Derif. One of my favorite wines, but they're also a biodynamic and organic process winery.
They are, yeah. And just for context, for that 365-day ferment, normally fermentation is 7 days, so that's a long time.
Yeah,
yeah.
So, yeah, it's one of the most wild and funky and interesting wines you'll ever have. It is not for the faint-hearted at all.
No, big boy.
Well, before we move on to our final four questions that you have no idea about. I will say that all of the wineries that we have spoken about today will be listed in our show notes on any of the services that you're listening to us on. But let's dive into these final four questions.
I'm a bit afraid.
Don't be. Now, I just want some quick fire answers from you.
Uh-huh.
You ready?
Yes.
What's your shot of choice?
I mean, that Port Charlotte that we had yesterday was pretty freaking good.
Yeah, that's always one of my favorites.
But my first gut instinct was Buffalo Trace, but yeah, not because
that's perfect.
But right. Not because I would choose it, but because that's what I deserve.
Yeah. What's your guilty pleasure drink?
Oh, Pina Colada or like Midori Splice.
Midori Splice.
Anything
I like that.
Anything kind of creamy tropical.
Yeah. How do you like your martini, shaken or stirred?
I guess like stirred.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Now, we recognize that it should be stirred, but, you know, there is no wrong way to drink anything, really, which also lends me into my last question.
Uh-huh.
What are your thoughts on red wine and Coke?
Oh, all for it.
Yeah?
100%. I've had the most wonderful times on Calimocho.
Yeah. It's a massive thing in South America, and it was, wasn't until we had this chat with Vula, our producer. Yeah.
Horrified.
Never heard of it before, but it's pretty common globally, right?
I feel like we might have drunk red wine and Coke before. Yeah. Okay, yeah, great. Yeah, I went to this music festival in Europe with these Spaniards, and it's the best thing because you get a red bag in a box.
Mm-hmm.
You get like, you know, it doesn't have to be cold Coke, and it's just the perfect little throw together camping. Not like it's pretty sweet, but it's like it's a red wine. It's
low alcohol as well.
Well, it depends how you make it.
But comparatively, to say spirit and Coke or, you know.
Well, yeah. Depends on your mix. But I will say that is just something that everyone should try.
Yeah.
I'm horrified by his thought.
And it will be a revelation.
Yeah. There is no wrong way to drink anything.
It's an incredible drink in a pinch.
Yeah. Well, on that note, thank you so much for joining me today. It's been an absolute pleasure. Now we've got all this wine to drink.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I'm not mad.
No, neither am I. So good to see you again and talk to you about all this incredible wine. Thank you.
Thank you. Love your guts, Lucky.
Love you. Cheers. Thank you for joining me on another episode of Spirited Discussions. I hope you had as much fun as I have and have been able to take away something you didn't know. Don't forget to like, subscribe, and share with your friends, and please join me next time on Spirited Discussions.